How relevant are the UN's Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs, for local economic growth and placemaking?
And how can you use the SDGs most effectively in developing strategies and delivering change?
What can the UK learn from good practice globally in the application of the SDGs for local and regional development? I'm Mike Spicer.
And I'm David Marlowe. Welcome to LED Confidential, the podcast that tries to lift the lid on those intractable, enduring challenges facing those of us working in and on LED and placemaking today.
And to another really special episode as we turn our attention to the UN SDGs and explore why they should probably be at the forefront of places' strategy and policy development. David, the SDGs have come up a number of times now in LEDC episodes over the last year, and also in the feedback that we've had from listeners as a topic that they'd like to discuss in greater detail. So some of our listeners will know the SDGs as the successors to the Millennium Development Goals. There are 17 of them, and they were adopted by the UN in 2015. The 17 global goals aim to end poverty, protect the planet, and ensure peace and prosperity for all by 2030. They're not legally binding or mandatory for any country, but some countries have taken steps to incorporate them into their national laws and policies. And the UK government has, to be fair, shown considerable commitment to them, at least in terms of their words, claiming to have integrated them into departmental planning processes and committing to publish its sustainability disclosure standards for them later this year. David, how do you want us to address this over the next 40 minutes or so?
I mean, thanks, Mike. And I am really excited to come back to this. As you say, it's been a topic that's come up in several LEDC episodes and in some feedback. I mean, both of us come across references to the SDGs quite frequently in our work. But I guess we've often struggled with sort of moving from motherhood and apple pie aspirations to practical policies and delivery in real places. The SDGs need structures. It needs tools and processes for operationalizing them. And one such instrument is the Voluntary Local Review, the VLR. The Voluntary Local Review is a tool to report subnational progress towards achieving the Sustainable Development Goals. It's typically been championed by major cities, and around 200 VLRs are right now reported on and uploaded to the UN Sustainable Development website. I'll make sure we upload the link in our bonus materials because many of the VLRs make fascinating and really insightful and sometimes even inspirational reading. So you can imagine how thrilled I am to have as our guest today Alexandra Hinnicker. Alex is currently director of the Sustainability Initiative at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, which is where I met her last year. In a genuinely illustrious career, in her previous role, Alex was senior director in the New York City's mayor's office, where she was responsible for creating and implementing the world's first voluntary local review, making New York City the first city to report directly to the United Nations on its local implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals. I mean, so in many senses, actually, the current plus or minus 200 UN published reviews are one measure of Alex's impact on these agendas. And incidentally, I was actually looking on the website a couple of days ago, and at that time, there were only two UK VLRs published on the UN site. Bristol, which I think has genuinely majored on integrating the SDGs into its plans and operations, and London, whose Sustainability Development Commission uploaded their 2019 report. So, Alex, many, many thanks. I know you've actually had to get up quite early, given the time difference, to join us on LED Confidential. You've heard our provocations and our introductory remarks. Where would you like the conversation to go over the next 40 minutes or so?
Sure. Well, first, thanks so much for having me, David and Mike. This is my first podcast ever, so I'm really trusting you to lead me in a way that will be helpful for your listeners. I hope that this will be a very honest and frank conversation. I worked with Dutch people for a long time, so sometimes I'm too honest. Well, I think I want to talk about the fact that the Sustainable Development Goals are often sometimes considered to be superficial, and a lot of the people working on them don't help with that. They often just sort of throw up a few of the icons and say, look, we're doing it, without exploring the more detailed goals and targets that are the areas that help local authorities and global authorities figure out what they need to do to make the world more sustainable for all. And I think it's also really important to acknowledge the work that's been done to get to the Sustainable Development Goals, because a lot of times people act like this is the first time anyone's ever thought about the links between social, economic, and environmental justice, or thought about the importance of centering equity in what we do. But it's actually been a long process that can be dated back to decades. So those are the areas I'd like to explore.
I mean, perhaps I could start, because I did sort of, in a sense, blow your trumpet in terms of your role in the very first voluntary local review. And it was in a New York City mayor's office. And as you might know, in England in particular, we have moved recently to directly elected mayors in many city regions. Why should they be asking their teams to take the SDGs really seriously in translating mayoral political programs into practice?
There are a few reasons that I think that it's beneficial to use this framework to think through local policies in the UK. First of all, they are a globally agreed framework that lots of people have thought about. So looking at how local policies line up to this framework, you can better communicate with local and national authorities in the UK and in other countries. Of course, cities like to show off what they're doing. But more importantly, you can learn from other cities that are facing similar challenges, that have come up with solutions that may be able to be translated to the situation or the context that local authorities in the UK are working on.
And how did you, if you like, persuade the political leadership of New York that this was something that was genuinely relevant, impactful, and practical? Because you're right. I mean, we said in the intro, you know, sometimes it sounds superficial and sometimes it sounds like motherhood and apple pie. Of course, we're interested in tackling poverty. Of course, we want peace and justice for all. But how do you persuade what would probably be quite a sort of experienced politician that this is of real practical help?
Well, I think within government, local government, there are sort of two sides. There's, as you mentioned, the more political side, politicians who are elected. And then there are the civil servants, the people who are doing the work that have been there for a long time. And in order to really communicate the importance of the Sustainable Development Goals, you need to get both on board. And so what I did was, New York City is mandated to create a sustainable development strategy every 4 years, and had already been working towards similar recognition that equity was at the center of climate justice and sustainability issues. So they published their strategy in 2015. And then a little bit later in the year, the world leaders came together at the UN in New York City and agreed to the Sustainable Development Goals. I wasn't at the New York City Mayor's Office for International Affairs at that time, so I want to recognize that my predecessors are the one who established the program to make these links between New York City and the Sustainable Development Goals. But when I came there, all they had done was sort of a mapping saying, look, our strategy is relevant to the goals like this. This is where New York City's strategy lines up with the Sustainable Development Goals, and there was a book. And that was an important first step, but my question was like, so what? Who cares? Yeah, local authorities are doing it. That's neat. How can we translate this into actionable items where New York City can, most importantly, better serve its own residents? So I think it's really important for anyone, whether it's a university or a local authority or a country or a private sector representative or a civil society organization, to sit down and say, why am I engaging with these goals? Who are my constituents and how will they benefit? And you need to understand that before you jump into doing the mapping, hiring people to do all of this sort of engagement. Think through what the benefits are for your constituents, whether it be residents, local businesses, universities, and then get into the question of where there's already activities happening across the Sustainable Development Goals to demonstrate that this is not something new. Like, cities are approached every day, like we were in New York City, with a new framework or a new idea, and they just want to get done what they've been working on doing. Like, I think, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the LEED framework. There are a few other US-specific development frameworks, and cities are expected to come up with new commitments and new analyses and new metrics all of the time. And it's really important to underscore that the Sustainable Development Goals are not that same kind of commitment. They're more an opportunity, not an obligation, to think through what cities are doing currently to make the world more sustainable for all and how they can do better. And it's important to emphasize that not every single resident or every single city official can list off the 17 goals, 169 targets, and 232 indicators, but that they have a comprehensive understanding about how their work is contributing to these broader objectives and how they can better work with the partners within their city government and with other civil society actors, private sector, to achieve these goals.
It'd be good to hear a little bit more about your experience from New York and how you used the SDG. What did it look like in terms of the engagement that you had with community groups, be they business groups or voluntary organizations? How did you operationalize the SGs to kind of engage with them? How enthusiastic were they about using that as a framework? And did you feel any bottom-up pressure from them to kind of go further on the SDGs?
So I'm glad that you asked that question about how we engaged with local civil society organizations. We, as the New York City Mayor's Office for International Affairs, did not. That was what our partners were doing. Those relationships already existed between the various departments and their constituencies, whether it was the Community Gardens Program or the Economic Development Program. So we didn't want to go out and speak to those same people and introduce this new concept of the 17 goals and so on and so forth. The way I approached it was more an internal government outreach program where I looked at what the various departments across the government were doing, mapped it to the Sustainable Development Goals, figured out how they were all interconnected, and I approached the departments to talk to them about what they were doing and how it contributed to the goals. That's where we really unlocked some important connections. I don't think, this is my personal opinion, and it depends on the city and context, that every resident needs to know what the Sustainable Development Goals are. That's a huge lift. And cities already have their own planning priorities and methods of engagement that they've undertaken. And to go out to residents or to community partners and present yet another framework might be overwhelming. But the Sustainable Development Goals can be used as a way to think about how their framework that they are already using can be improved or that they can better coordinate with other partners to learn about areas where they can do better.
I mean, if you were going to, I mean, this is building on Mike's point, if you were going to point out one or two things that were different at a very practical level on local communities or the local economy, you know, after the process had been through, I mean, what sort of things would you point to?
Yeah, I think the number one priority is not going to anyone and immediately starting off with talking about the Sustainable Development Goals. That's totally overwhelming. And people, like I mentioned, have already done a lot of work. Like, nobody is not thinking about these issues already. So it's really important for whoever is going out to do this to have sat down, done the work on their own to think through how the Sustainable Development Goals are discussed in whichever community. So let's say, for example, in New York City, there was already the One NYC strategy that the city had gone through a really long process, a consultative process of talking to different partners to understand how New York City could set a new round of goals for New York City sustainability objectives. So I didn't go out to people and say, how are you contributing to goal one, no poverty? Because they'd be like, what are you talking about? But rather, hey, in your strategy, you undertake these four programs, and actually those are contributing not only to the goal on reducing poverty, but also the goal on gender equality or the goal on peaceful, just, and inclusive societies. That really opened up conversations where people got excited about the idea of talking about their work beyond the very specific technical box that they were working in within their department. But yeah, absolutely don't talk about the Sustainable Development Goals is the first thing.
If you're talking about their existing programs, how did the people who got involved in the review actually develop in a perhaps slightly different direction because of that process?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there are a few different ways in the case of New York that I think that engaging with the Sustainable Development Goals really helped move forward the conversation about what sustainability is and who should be involved in the conversations. The first one was that I started engaging the New York City Mayor's Office for Human Rights. I started talking to our Office for Consumer and Worker Protection, for our Office for Historic Preservation. And these were partners who were not represented in the 2015 sustainability strategy. But through the Sustainable Development Goals, we saw that they were doing completely relevant work that should be part of the conversation. So when New York City started developing their 2019 strategy, I mentioned it, it happens every 4 years, the Mayor's Office of Climate, who leads the process, invited me to be part of the strategy planning team so that I could bring in what I had learned from reviewing broader New York City activities and how they were contributing to sustainability beyond what had previously been captured in the 2015 strategy. Since you're in the UK, there's another thing that I want to emphasize, which is that when people identify solutions, they don't have to mention the Sustainable Development Goals. So it's not always clear that the Sustainable Development Goals were the underlying factor that brought people together to identify a solution. Our New York City Department of Consumer and Worker Protection and a few other offices were looking at the question of pay equity in New York City. It's terrible. Pay equity in the US is horrible. No clue what to do about it. The UK has some really interesting programs. And because I had partnered with the International Labour Organization through the framework of the Sustainable Development Goals to connect our colleagues to the International Labour Organization to talk about these sorts of issues, they established that relationship and ended up connecting with representatives from the UK to learn from them about how New York City could better implement pay equity policies. And in fact, there was a pay equity hearing. In New York, we have these hearings where people can come in and share their thoughts on what a policy should be and what sort of consideration should be taken on board. And representatives from the International Labour Organization came and shared the example of, I think, the national UK example and a few others that informed policy discussions in New York City around improving pay equity. But nobody mentioned the Sustainable Development Goals, and that's okay.
So I think what I'm hearing, Alex, is that it's what the SDGs represent rather than a particular language is adopted around it. You know, it's almost kind of, you know, it's a framework, but it doesn't need to be an explicit one necessarily. It can be something that we build on. And my question to you is going to be about, I was thinking about two of the goals in particular, which feel quite familiar, I think, to those of us working in economic development in the UK. And those are 8 and 12. So the decent work goal and also the responsible consumption and production. I think many listeners to this podcast might recognize some of that in, for example, circular economy type strategies that we are increasingly popular within UK cities, a number of them kind of doing pilot programs at the moment around that. And also what I think we do explicitly call the decent work agenda. It feels almost, I'm trying to get a sense of which way around was it? Are you seeing SDGs kind of influencing or the kind of the hidden hand of the SDGs in the way that civil society groups kind of, you know, present their frameworks to policymakers? Or is it just coincidence? Is it influential? Are people kind of using the SDGs more to push their individual interests? I guess is what I'm getting at.
I think it's somewhere in between the two. It's not one or the other. I'm glad you mentioned goal 8, decent work and economic growth, because when discussions started around which sustainable development goals should be included, there wasn't any clear understanding of how many there would be or which topics would be addressed or so on. But the International Labour Organization very explicitly from the start set out to develop a goal on decent work and economic growth. They wanted this to be part of global discussions and recognized as a topic. So they really pushed for that. And so I think for every single goal, there was a group of civil society representatives, UN organizations, national authorities who were interested in pushing that goal forward so that it could be one of those 17 icons to remind people that it was important. So even getting to the point where the goal was there was part of this process of community groups and others engaging to push it forward. And now I think it's really helpful. And again, I mentioned the example of New York as a reminder for people to think about why that's so important to sustainable development, to have that there and to demonstrate not just the overarching decent work and economic growth, but the specific targets laid out is really important. And it's interesting, during the voluntary local review, the first one, I engaged the New York City Economic Development Corporation, and they said, oh, no, we don't do sustainability. Because, of course, when people hear sustainability, they think of Goal 12, responsible consumption and production, recycling, so on and so forth. But when I showed them that their work was reflected in those targets, they became really excited and interested. And we started talking about how their work was relevant to this broader framework. It's such a broad, it's hard to say who is influencing whom and so on and so forth. But having these globally agreed goals and targets really is something that anyone can point to and say, this is important for everyone. So this isn't a topic that we need to talk about within our context, whatever that may be.
Yeah, I mean, so much of LED and placemaking is a bit chicken and egg. I remember our very, very first episode was, you know, which comes first, the evidence or the narrative of place? You were obviously involved in New York City's first voluntary local review, which was posted on the UN site, and there are now 200. And I said in the beginning, you know, there's only two UK ones that I could find when I looked a couple of days ago. I'm sure it's the same in the US, and, you know, perhaps in Pittsburgh for all I know. But there are so many pressures on policymakers and policy developers, and actually so much hollowing out has gone on during recent financial tensions and financial troubles in the public sector. Is there a case amongst all the reviews that we do for cities and towns and regions to embark on a voluntary local review in 2024? And how has the process changed since the original ones that you did back in the middle of the last decade?
First, I want to also acknowledge that New York City wasn't the first to sit down and think about how their work was relevant to the Sustainable Development Goals and look at how we might report on progress. However, New York City was the first to formally engage the United Nations and set up this sort of mechanism. So I remember when I started the job in, 2017, that summer, I met with Amelia Saez, who is the head of United Cities and Local Government. And there was a side event on how to get cities engaged. And it was very much a side event. And I thought, okay, I've been working in and around the UN for about 10, 15 years at that time. How can we take this really important city work and translate that to the UN context? And I'm half joking that creating an acronym that was relevant to existing acronyms within the UN system would be helpful. So the fact that there are voluntary national reviews that national governments are invited to present every year already existed was really helpful for thinking about creating the process for voluntary local reviews to make it clear that they were part of this process that we were looking at to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals. So if you go on the site, you'll see that there are reports that happened before 2018, and those are great. The change is that this more formally became part of the process. The UN has adopted it. UN Habitat has an entire department related to this, same with UNDESA, to think through how this might be relevant. You mentioned Pittsburgh as an example, and you came to Pittsburgh, and we've talked about it, and you're familiar, David, a little bit with the sort of setup of how different stakeholders interact here in Pittsburgh. The previous mayor of Pittsburgh, Bill Peduto, did publish a voluntary local review. I advised a Carnegie Mellon University student on doing this voluntary local review. And then he didn't win the next round of the election. So you have a new mayor who has different priorities. And oftentimes this happens when any public office switches over. They want to step away from whatever the previous mayor did. So I think that's why I mentioned at the outset, the importance of getting both the political support from a mayor, but also the support of the civil servants who are actually doing the work. So I don't want to say people shouldn't do voluntary local reviews, but I think that before you get to that point, it's really important to get partners on board for understanding why it's important and how it will benefit a region, because otherwise it can very much come across as an effort by an elected representative to make themselves look good. So in the case of Pittsburgh, we've been doing some really wonderful work convened by Sustainable Pittsburgh, which is an organization that works in the southwestern Pennsylvania region. They've brought together stakeholders, including city and county officials, the nonprofit sector, universities, to think about how we can apply these regionally so that even as elected officials come and go, we still have that underlying knowledge and commitment from regional partners who will be here for a while, who will continue to move forward the work we've done to look at how the Sustainable Development Goals are applicable. And we can present this to newly elected officials as an opportunity for them to improve what they're doing and help them meet the goals that they've laid out for their administration.
You've sort of embarked on answering a question I was just about to ask you, Alex, which was around kind of navigating some of the challenges we all have with key person dependency in the production of strategies of various kinds in economic development. I think in this country, in the UK, we're used to seeing quite a high turnover of civil servants within the departments that typically engage most intensively on the issue of economic development. How do you kind of embed that way of thinking institutionally in a way that survives changes of personnel? What practical ways can you make it stick?
Again, I don't think that every civil servant needs to be able to list off the Sustainable Development Goals, but rather this framework can be a way for them to think through how to improve policies and procedures. And the shift in policies and procedures that happens over time that helps meet the needs of the people that they're meant to serve is the most important aspect of it. So it's not that, oh gosh, we have a new round of people working. Do they know what the Sustainable Development Goals are? But rather, we have a new round of people working. Are they going to implement these local economic development policies that center people, that center equity, that also take into consideration environmental and social factors? And that's the real metric of success, in my opinion.
I suppose some of the things that I like about the SDGs, to sort of personalize it for a minute, is, I mean, firstly, they are cross-cutting. You know, poverty is not typically the remit of one department of either government or indeed of local government, or neither actually is sustainability. As you say, there used to be this association with recycling or sustainable production and consumption. But typically, all of these things cut across virtually every department. So there are a set of principles and values that you can use to, if you like, do the institutional embedding that Mike talks about. I mean, secondly, what I like is that they're global. I mean, it sort of forces you to look at, at what other places are doing. It creates some sort of common language, I guess, that allows a city or a district in the UK to genuinely communicate with, whether it's Pittsburgh or whether it's actually somewhere in the global south, and say, how did you deal with poverty, or how did you deal with sustainability, or how did you deal with human rights, or whatever it is. I mean, thirdly, and this is my next question to you really, is that certainly in 2015, they were visionary. They were long-term. They went beyond a political cycle. But we're now in 2024, and they were 2030 goals. Sort of casting your mind forward, what do you see as the next strategic part of the journey for SDGs or their successors? Because let's be honest, we're now not in a generational project. We're now like 5 years away.
Yeah, this is where I think the importance of recognizing the history about how the Sustainable Development Goals came about is really important. They didn't magically appear in 2012 when people came together. They didn't magically appear with the Millennium Development Goals. Sustainable Development Goals can be traced back to 1972 with the Stockholm meeting, where more developed countries decided to invite less developed countries to come together to talk about development. And that was revolutionary at that time. And over a series of meetings and agreements since, I guess that's 50 years now, there's been a shift in understanding of how development should take place. It's not just top down from the world's industrialized countries. We need to take into consideration the perspective of the people who are impacted, of local authorities, of universities, of the private sector. And this takes time when you do it on a global scale. So when people say, especially, oh, the sustainable development goals aren't working, we aren't achieving them, I think they're too focused on the very technical aspects of measuring and so on and so forth, and not thinking about the really important shifts that have taken place where cities are now recognized as a critical player in international discussions around sustainability, where civil society and other partners are taking place in these discussions and having influence on where we go with sustainability. And I think that what, no matter what the next framework is, whatever it's called, whatever acronym they decide, the most important progress that needs to be made, I think, is making sure that we engage the people who are impacted or the people who are addressing these issues day in, day out in discussions around finding the solutions rather than having it just as a top-down approach. And I think a really important development in that sense is that the UN Secretary General set up a task force of local authorities to advise him on these sorts of issues. Of course, the UN is always going to be member states at the country level, but how other stakeholders can engage has shifted over time. And I think we need to continue to make space for those perspectives and finding solutions, even if they're not sitting at the table with other countries in a formal setting. And that's going to continue, and that must continue in order for us to achieve whatever the next round of frameworks we agree to.
And on a personal note, if there was like one or two things that you could advocate in that discussion over the next 5 years, I mean, just give us a sense of what they would be. A really difficult question.
I think that what I would advocate for is precisely that. It's a shift in recognition of who's responsible for developing these policies and making these decisions. What I didn't mention earlier is that I worked in some of the world's most bombed and mined countries on landmine and bomb clearance programs and the process of developing the international treaties to ban landmines and cluster munitions. And what really has informed my approach to everything I do related to sustainable development is a critical role that the people impacted by those issues, meaning the survivors of those incidents, people living on mined land, the people clearing that, were central in calling for a treaty banning the weapon. And that's what really made those processes stand out. The international campaign to ban landmines won the Nobel Peace Prize precisely because they brought the people most impacted forward to drive the solutions. And I think that we really need to do that no matter what the context is to think who is most impacted, what are their needs, and how can we address those in order to find sustainable solutions.
And just thinking about the present, Alex, so if we think about the SDGs as they are now, I was thinking before that sustainable development as a phrase is something that is common currency within the world of economic development. It's probably the most used phrase, I would suggest. But there's a lot to unpack in that phrase, 17 goals as they now stand. Do you feel, from your experience of looking at countries across the world, how they apply the SDGs, how they report against them, that there are any particular dimensions of these as they stand now that are underappreciated or perhaps, and then let's think about developed countries for the moment. So the USA, the UK, and some others. Do they have blind spots? Are there particular SDGs that they really need to work harder at?
Well, first I'd like to talk about the blind spots overall with the Sustainable Development Goals in the United States, which of course is only one of five countries which hasn't conducted a voluntary national review, which was part of my inspiration for creating the voluntary local review. The others are Haiti, Myanmar, Yemen, and South Sudan. So here's the thing. The U.S. now, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, has started talking about the Sustainable Development Goals and how important they are and so on, but they still strictly think about it as an international development issue and how they engage with other countries. They're not applying it internally to their own context. They just don't think it applies. And I imagine it's similar with the UK, where there's a strong, long history of development and aid, cooperation and so on. So these type of topics are very much considered an other thing where you provide assistance to other countries for those countries to achieve the goals, but they're not so comfortable applying them internally. And one topic that I will tell you, I am still shocked to this day that it made it to its own goal, is Goal 16 on peace, justice, and strong institutions, and looking not just at reduction in violence, which of course I think is very important, but strengthening institutions, transparency in government, topics like that, which are universal challenges and also not topics people are so comfortable talking about in the way that they can say our water isn't clean or so on. I think the challenge is for that mind shift for governments such as the US and UK to think about how this is applicable internally and not just externally. And cities can help drive that because cities are at the forefront of implementing these solutions. And so they can say, here's the challenges that we're facing as a city, and here's how we're addressing it. And it's really important that you take part in finding these solutions to make our country sustainable.
Those are really wise words. I like your last two points a lot. I mean, the first one about the agency of local communities in increasing in the next iteration of SDGs is something that I do think Mike and I encounter a lot in our work. LED and placemaking cannot be top down. It has to be informed by community influence and local agencies. And then this issue of looking inwards and not always thinking, actually, we're fine on Goal 16 because, self-evidently, after what the UK's been through in recent years, we've got quite a bit to do on justice and strong institutions, to say the least.
And it does feel as well, David, I mean, thinking about individual goals, going back to Alex's point about thinking about these things as international development goals rather than something more universal to strive for, I think is a really important point. So I think in our work, we sometimes see, if you take the goal, for example, on clean water and sanitation, it's not one you traditionally associate with a developed country almost by definition. But of course, the pressures of development can sometimes bring that to the fore, of course. The trade-off between, water stress and providing new land for development and so on. And as David says, on maintaining the integrity of institutions, as a goal, it feels like we kind of encounter those pressures without necessarily internalizing development against them as a kind of core element of strategy making. I think we certainly see that in the UK, but it's interesting to hear that almost that experience is reflected elsewhere as well.
Yeah, and then actually one of the big social movements of the last couple of years has been the repulsion at the state of our water courses, actually. It is really interesting. I mean, I think we're beginning to draw towards a close. And I mean, Alex, you're part of Carnegie Mellon University. And in the UK in particular, there are increasing demands on universities to be leaders and supporters of change. What sort of examples can you give us from your experience of where universities have actually discharged that type of role well that might have applicability in the UK and elsewhere?
I actually was recruited to come to Carnegie Mellon University in 2020 to help start up their Sustainable Development Goals program and conduct the world's first voluntary university review. It's sort of becoming a thing now. And what interested me so much about it was going beyond the operational questions that we think about in the city context to look at the additional dimensions of education and research. So as a university, we have a responsibility to educate students about these topics who will eventually become the ones who are addressing and implementing solutions. We are also conducting groundbreaking research that's relevant to a lot of the goals. And I'll tell you, this is my first experience in higher education. It is a slog to get people who are really caught up in their academic disciplines to think about real-world contexts. And so that's what I've been focusing on is saying, like, we have this amazing research going on. There are these people out there who have these really big challenges. How can we better link those together so that the research you're doing can be connected both here in Pittsburgh, nationally and internationally at UN Fora, to think about actually implementing solutions, getting out of the lab or whatever it is, or libraries, and like using this, your great brains and knowledge to help be part of this global movement to make the world more sustainable. And that's been really exciting, but it's really hard because, again, the Sustainable Development Goals, 17 goals, 169 targets, 232 indicators, academics, students, nobody has time to learn additional frameworks. So what I've really been focused on is taking everyone's existing work and saying, this is how it's connected. And that's what people get excited and interested in. And then they start becoming part of the conversation. One area which is new to me that I think is really the highlight of my job right now is I've hired a team of now 7 interns from different parts of the university. I've not really worked with youth in this sort of meaningful way before, but it is so helpful to hear their perspective on this. I find it very frustrating when people dismiss the voice of my younger colleagues because they really have a completely different mindset, and we need to take that on board when thinking about our solutions, when we become cynical, when we've seen the same thing over and over again, to help reframe it so that we can actually make progress rather than getting caught up in the same cycles.
I mean, that's been fabulous, and I'm really, really grateful for your time. I'll say a few final words, and then Mike can sort of close us off. I really like the concept of these voluntary reviews, whether it's, in a sense, national, local, even now you've introduced me to voluntary university reviews, and having a set of lenses which can, A, be cross-cutting, B, be comparable across different nations, different contexts, different cultures, and can allow a certain amount of agency to communities, to young people that perhaps have often been swept away in the sort of hierarchy of member states doing things and developed countries doing things and not really being prepared to engage in a voluntary way with local agency with different groups. So I hope that our listeners will have found that a useful overview of how SDGs can be relevant to their work in quite a light touch, but very, very meaningful way. And I'm very grateful for your contributions. Thanks so much for joining us.
And a big thanks for me, Alex, for coming on the show. For our listeners, as ever, you can get bonus material on this and other episodes on our website, which is ledconfidential.co.uk. Drop us a line, tell us what you think, share your ideas for future episodes, and we shall take them up. Catch you on the next one.